It's Wednesday, April 26th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, big primary wins put party frontrunners closer to the White House. Millions are being affected by drought in Malawi.
A remote person could potentially shut down the system, and that, I think, was unacceptable to investigators who looked at it after the fact.
Authorities race to stop potential attacks against power grids. Also ahead, a nuclear disaster site has lots of new tourist life and muscle cars for China. It's all on today's International Edition. The road to the White House just got narrowed a bit as the leading party candidate scored big wins on Tuesday. VOA senior national correspondent Jim Malone joins us. Let's begin with Democrat Hillary Clinton.
She won four out of the five primaries at stake. She won a big victory in Pennsylvania. It's a state she has ties to from her youth. It's the kind of state that'll be important in the general election. Clinton right now is about 88% at least of the way toward clinching the number of delegates she needs to nail down the nomination. Bernie Sanders remains defiant, yet there's the sort of slight change in tone, maybe. He made the argument at a rally in West Virginia that he's still the better election, general election candidate, according to the polls.
Almost every national poll and every state poll has us defeating Trump, and that margin for us is significantly larger than that of Secretary Clinton.
The path that Sanders has, and he's even acknowledged it in an interview now with the Associated Press, is so narrow that I think the pressure will just continue to mount on the Democratic side for Sanders to find a way to kind of move aside at some point. And, you know, then we'll get some serious negotiations between Clinton and Sanders about him supporting her in a fulsome way for the general election.
And no lack of symbolism that Hillary Clinton gave her speech in Philadelphia, where the Democratic convention will be.
With your help, we're going to come back to Philadelphia for the Democratic National Convention. With the most votes and the most pledged delegates. And we will unify our party to win this election.
Yeah, she's going to be back in Philadelphia in July. Bernie Sanders will be there in July. Clinton is already reminding him that in 2008, when she lost out to Barack Obama, she did not make any demands on Mr. Obama in order for him to win her support. So we'll see how this plays out. I think most Democrats right now are going to consider that the race is pretty much over, but they want Sanders to be a fulsome supporter of Clinton. They don't want to see him in any way disrespected, tossed aside. And he did create a lot of energy in the party. He brought in independents, and particularly with young people, it was an area where Clinton struggled, and she'll need that help come November.
Among the Republicans, Donald Trump swept all five states that were being contested in this Tuesday set of elections and looks to be in very good shape now.
He swept them, and many by impressive margins.
The best way to beat the system is have evenings like this, where you get record-setting votes, where you get record-setting delegates. I use the analogy of the boxer. You know, when the boxer knocks out the other boxer, you don't have to wait around for a decision. So that's what it is. And that's what happened tonight. That's what happened last week in New York. And that's really what's been happening throughout.
The anti-Trump forces are probably gone into hiding at this point because it's difficult to see how they could mount a sustained effort now in a way to deny him the nomination. Now, that being said, Ted Cruz made some comments Tuesday in Indiana. Why there? Well, in a week's time, Indiana will hold a primary. Cruz sees that as his last, perhaps best hope to stop or at least slow down Donald Trump. The idea, again, is to deny him enough delegates so that he comes to Cleveland short of the 1237 number he needs to claim the nomination outright. The five victories on Tuesday, and even Trump said he thought it was his biggest night of the campaign so far, clearly put him on a path to the nomination. But I would say a Trump victory in Indiana next Tuesday would probably seal the deal.
Well, always impressive is VOA senior national correspondent Jim Malone. Jim, thanks for your analysis.
Always a pleasure.
Turning to our social media segment, International Edition's G. Abby Lee joins me in the studio with what's buzzing online. Hello, G.
Hi, Jim.
So, what was the trending hashtag regarding primaries today?
It was hashtag election 2016 and hashtag I voted. When you use the hashtag I voted, Twitter generates a graphic of a box with a checkmark for you. Hashtag Super Tuesday is no longer popular. There were some complaints from Maryland voters on Twitter. The state switched back to paper ballots, and according to some tweets, scanners at several precincts didn't work properly.
Oh my, and what did the presidential hopefuls tweet?
Let's begin with the Democratic contenders. Bernie Sanders was encouraging his Twitter followers to come out and vote, and Clinton focused on targeting minority and female voters. Her campaign tweeted in Spanish and shared clips of her recent town hall meeting where she talked about gun violence and gender equality.
Well, as you recall, this time yesterday on the GOP side, we covered this rather strange alliance between Ted Cruz and John Kasich.
That's right. And communication strategist Keith Emmer, at Keith Emmer on Twitter, criticized the effectiveness of the alliance. He tweeted, "Cruz and Kasich, don't vote for me now, so you can vote for me later, is a complicated pitch. Trump's simplicity still has his advantage." And frontrunner Donald Trump shared 5 different clips encouraging voters to cast their ballots. The roughly 20-second long videos all feature his famous daughter, Ivanka Trump. Ted Cruz and John Kasich also encouraged their supporters to get out and vote, but their Twitter feeds lack multimedia aspects.
Oh, I see. Well, speaking of the Republican Party, Chris Christie is trending on social media as well. Oh, my goodness. Tell us about this one.
Sure. New Jersey Governor Chris Christie was captured on camera dancing at a Bruce Springsteen concert in Brooklyn. That video is making the rounds on the internet. Back to you, Jim.
Well, view that one if you dare. Thanks for the analysis, G. And you may follow her on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. I post there as well at VOA Stevenson. And of course, we always invite you to follow the International Edition stream. That's found at VOA_IE. Nearly 3 million people in Malawi are facing food shortages as drought is gripping southern Africa. The government has declared a national disaster. Lamech Messina reports for VOA from hard-hit southern Malawi, where people are already feeling the impact.
Dry, scorched fields like this one have become a common sight in southern Malawi. Flash floods and dry spells caused by El Nino weather patterns hit the maize crop, leading to a deficit of about 1 million metric tons. This follows a disappointing harvest last year as well. Crops like potatoes and cassava proved more resilient.
We have long been relying on maize, but this year the crop did not do well. Now we are relying on these pigeon peas we believe will bail us out from hunger.
Families are having to find alternatives to the maize porridge they would normally eat.
Many days we eat pumpkins that we sometimes find in our failed maize field.
Food prices have gone up at the market. The price of maize has tripled.
We have to raise the prices because we have to transport it from farther away. But people are not buying. They don't have enough money.
Nearly half of Malawi's children were already chronically undernourished in 2014. Now 4% of children are suffering severe acute malnutrition, according to UNICEF. Water sources have also been affected.
Almost all the taps around our area have run dry. In most cases, we wake up around 2 a.m. to try to get water at the only kiosk.
The next harvest is 12 months away. About 2.8 million people already will need food aid into 2017, and aid agencies expect that number to balloon in the coming months. Lamech Messina for VOA News, Blantyre, Malawi.
This is VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Hi there.
there. This is Larry London, the host of Border Crossings. Nice to meet you. I would love for you to join us each and every day, Monday through Friday, on Border Crossings for requests, dedications, giveaways, and surprise guests. We've got some of today's biggest hitmakers coming into the studio to talk about their music. And all we're missing is you. So join us Monday to Friday, right here on Border Crossings. This is the Voice of America. This is VOA's International Edition. With volatile world financial markets and even debate in the UK over a possible exit from the European Union, some experts in West and Central Africa are again suggesting that it may be time to reform the relationship of the CFA franc and the euro. Emily Yab reports from Abidjan.
Some in West and Central Africa say the region has outgrown the CFA franc, arguing it should be unpegged from the euro or just abandoned altogether. Ivorian economist Serafin Praoyeo wrote a book on the topic in 2012. He says the exchange rate of a country must take into account the weight of its commercial partners. And today the eurozone is not their only partner anymore. He says they should also be taking into account the US dollar and Asian currencies. He says pegging the CFA to the euro makes the currency too rigid and too strong. France created the CFA franc for its African colonies in 1945. France guarantee a fixed exchange rate with the euro, and in return, member states must deposit half of their currency reserve in the French treasury, something some analysts say has slowed down development. The French finance minister said in April that France is open to changing this arrangement, but that the initiative must come from member countries. The 14 countries using the CFA are divided into two monetary unions, but any country can decide to abandon the currency at any time. Both Guinea and Morocco created their own currencies at independence. Morocco is cited as a success story, while Guinea, with its year of chronic high inflation, is not. Economists warn that having your own currency carries risk. They point to current financial crises in Nigeria and Zimbabwe.
Le franc CFA a permis aux pays membres.
Ivorian economist Antoine Awa Junior says that the strict monetary policies under the CFA franc has allowed member countries to have a stable and strong currency, which has allowed them to trade externally and to stabilize their economies. Even critics of the CFA franc agree that there are risks and that good governance is key. Yao says simply untying the CFA franc from the euro will not automatically make us emerging economies. Our leaders will need to really govern it well, he says. Earlier this year, Ivorian President Alassane Ouattara, a former governor of the Central Bank of West African State, praised the CFA franc for maintaining growth and keeping inflation under control. West African analyst at the London-based Chatham House, Paul Melly, says big economies like Senegal and Ivory Coast could break off on their own if they wanted to, but that's unlikely.
For the smaller countries, for a country like Benin or Togo, or for the Sahelian countries, which are very exposed to the risk of drought at least every second year, the idea of breaking away onto their own, it would leave them very exposed to pressure. It would be much harder for them to maintain a stable currency and monetary position on their own.
But it is an emotional topic for some who see the CFA currency as another vestige of colonialism to be cast off. Last year, Chadian President Idriss Déby said the region should instead have a 100% African currency, and the Economic Community of West African State has professed the goal of creating a common currency since the regional bloc's inception in 1975. Emilia for VOA News in Abidjan.
Many parts of Africa and elsewhere in the world experience regular power outages. There are many reasons for the disruptions. Almost all are unintentional. But for areas of the world not used to a frequent loss of electricity, a sudden plunge into darkness means an interruption of many systems relied upon constantly, like computers, communications, food storage, even traffic lights. An intentional attack on a power grid could pose even more ominous consequences. The first believed such successful attack took place just over a year ago in Ukraine. International Business Times senior writer Eric Markowitz joins us to explain what happened and how U.S. agencies have responded.
Hackers got into a power grid system in western Ukraine, and they did so basically by kind of a classic phishing campaign. They got an employee's username and password. They logged into the system, and they were in there for a few months, and then one day decided, okay, now's the day. And they essentially just shut down the entire power system for the region, and it affected about 225,000 people. It shut off their electricity for 5-6 hours, and it really left the entire community, and really in some ways the whole world, scrambling for answers of, you know, why did this happen, how did it happen, and could it happen in other places?
The attack in Ukraine lasted only about 6 hours. This particular attack was relatively small.
It was small in the sense that no one was out of power for weeks. There was no reported fatalities from this. But I think the implications were really what matter here, and it really galvanized the security industry in both governments of Ukraine and the United States and other countries to really kind of look at their own systems and say, hey, if this could happen there, could it happen here as well?
Do we have a sense that from the investigation in Ukraine that perhaps something was learned in the manner of, A, how they were able to regain control, and B, how to potentially, you know, put in safeguards to stop something like this?
What the investigators learned was, you know, A, passwords need to be a little more sophisticated, and also to look at who has access to which parts of the system. If a remote employee could theoretically shut down the system, or would have to be someone on site. I think that was a major issue here, was a remote person could potentially shut down the system. And that, I think, was unacceptable to investigators who looked at it after the fact.
How similar is Ukraine's grid and system to, say, those of the United States?
It kind of depends which region we're talking about and which power company is operating. But the general sense is, both from the Department of Homeland Security and the FBI and many other government agencies, that we are at a real risk for this. There have been some recent attempts to try to get the power industry to care more about this, to care more about their security. Just as we've seen, there's been data breaches of major banks and hospitals and insurance companies. There's a real fear that it's potential that this could strike against the grid. And it's something even FEMA has begun to start to discuss about what would happen if hackers took down a big portion of the power grid.
I mean, in the old days, they must have had other ways to restore power rather than computers. It hasn't always been, you know, a technology-based system, I wouldn't think.
Right, and that's in some ways part of the problem, is that they've automated their systems. So in the past, in the days of yore, if something got shut down, they would just send a technician out and turn it back on, almost like a circuit breaker in your basement. But everything now is completely run on a network and somewhat connected to the internet, and that has created a lot of efficiencies for the companies, where they can automate. They can have, instead of 50 guys in 50 different offices, they can have one guy in the central office in front of one computer. And so getting the networks back on, if they were ever taken down, is much more laborious, because they just don't have the manpower to do it, because the systems they have now are so automated. So that's really part of the problem here.
International Business Times senior writer Eric Markowitz catches article online. After Ukraine cyber attacks, FBI and DHS urge U.S. power companies to develop better safety protocols. Eric, thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
It has been 30 years since the Chernobyl nuclear disaster that threatened much of Europe with a radioactive cloud. The site in Ukraine has become now a popular tourism attraction, especially for foreigners. VOA's Oksana Lihostova and Ruslan Danichenko visited the Chernobyl exclusion zone recently to find out why people want to visit this site. Molly McKitterick narrates their report.
Among the foreign tourists are Americans, Austrians, Czechs, and Swedes. Their reasons for visiting vary.
Just curiosity.
Danny Roberts says his sick brother wanted a picture of the site.
He knows more about Chernobyl than anyone, so for that reason I came today.
Belgian engineer François Douayen came to see the huge structure being built to cover the destroyed reactor.
I know that there are like a lot of French companies that work here, and I was curious to know how it was done.
Accompanied by the squeaking of dosimeter devices to measure radiation and the chirping of birds, the tourists roam through abandoned houses. In the midst of overgrown thickets, there's a storehouse, a country club, a kindergarten. In the Chernobyl exclusion zone, equal in size to Luxembourg, many surprises are hiding. A huge structure was once a top-secret military radar facility that could detect the launch of a missile on the other side of the Earth. Westerners called it the Russian woodpecker because of the specific sound it made over the airwaves. Tourists ride a bus to see the ghost city of Pripyat. Its residents were driven away on the third day following the accident and told the city would be washed and cleaned, and they would be brought right back. They were told to take nothing with them.
With foreigners, you must explain the bigger picture against the background of what was happening. A foreigner needs to understand why it happened, why people who lived in the Soviet Union thought one way and not otherwise.
One of the first travel companies that brought tourists was Chernobyl Tour. Its founder used to work at the site after the accident.
Radiation levels have fallen in such quantities since that time that tourism there, in a sense of short-term stay, is absolutely safe. Compared to what I personally measured there, levels decreased 1,000 times, which is a great success in overcoming the consequences of the accident.
Thousands of tourists visit Chernobyl every year, and the number is growing. Forbes magazine called it the most exotic place for tourism on Earth. Those who have visited agree that it is special, the only place on the entire planet where Judgment Day has already taken place. For Oksana Lihustova, Ruslan Denychenko of VOA's Ukrainian service, I'm Molly McKitterick.
And if you'd like to have a look for yourself, all you have to do is travel to our website at voanews.com. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. Happening right now. Right now is Beijing's largest car show, where they get to see all of the latest vehicles that manufacturers have that they're making. And the fastest growing segment in China's car market is for sport utility vehicles. They're being marketed as a popular option for China's rough rural roads and are the only product segment that's still growing currently in China. Last year, SUVs accounted for 1/3 of all vehicle sales in China, and industry analysts say that that figure could rise to half. Meanwhile, China has overtaken the United States last year as the biggest electric car market by the number of vehicles sold. Muscle cars were very popular 50 years ago among U.S. drivers, and now, as VOA Steve Miller reports, Ford is marketing a four-cylinder model in China.
Throughout the 1950s and 60s, muscle cars enjoyed enormous popularity, allowing the average person the opportunity to purchase some speed. In other parts of the world, drivers have a different need. Eric Merkel is a sales analyst at the Ford Motor Company, and he says that that factored into how the iconic Ford Mustang was marketed in China, where power wasn't the primary draw.
You spend a lot of time in traffic. So, you know, to really get the full exhilaration of a 5-liter V8, it's kind of hard to do. Mustang, for them, it's an American icon. It's more of a status symbol. They like to be seen in their cars.
The experience factor isn't just something those abroad are seeking either. Scott Evans, associate editor at Motor Trend.
These days, a lot of the original muscle cars are becoming desirable because they're little pieces of nostalgia, the little pieces of our past. When our parents had these muscle cars, you know, we remember riding around in them as kids.
So in a country like China, manufacturers face the challenge of providing a muscle car experience inside a package that's better suited to its driving environment. That usually means moving away from a large V8 to a smaller engine, a process that creates its own set of challenges.
There's a few issues in that we had to overcome.
That's Tom Barnes, vehicle engineer manager for the Ford Mustang.
The first one is we had to make sure it accelerated well. And what that meant is some of the EcoBoost engines that we had in the world, like we have a 1 liter, that didn't put her out enough. We didn't have enough. So we had to kind of go for the biggest I-4 we could.
Without getting too technical, Barron says they were able to cram a whole lot of power into a small four-cylinder engine. But there was one lingering problem they still needed to address.
A V8 sounds pretty cool. And I will tell you, an I-4 doesn't have that ability. But what we do is we use something called electronic sound enhancement, which is playing sounds of the engine through the speakers.
And while that might not exactly be the same as a throaty V8, Barnes says it does provide a good customer experience. So what's the future of muscle cars? Scott Evans doesn't think they're going away anytime soon, but with the rise of electric vehicles and demand for increased fuel efficiency.
Decades in the future, I think things like muscle cars, things like V8 engines are going to eventually become luxury items.
Steve Miller, VOA News, Washington.
You've been listening to International Edition. You can find us anytime at voanews.com, on Twitter at @VOA_IE. Our director is Tracy Carter, our audio engineer, Jimmy Cook, maybe future automobile engineer. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. Thank you so much for joining us. Have a super day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
According to the 2015 Country Reports on Human Rights Practices issued by the State Department in mid-April, Russia's authoritarian government continues to commit and ignore numerous human rights violations. First, citizens' right to choose their leadership in free and fair elections was consistently restricted to the government's efforts to suppress dissent. New and existing repressive laws were used to harass, discredit, and punish individuals and organizations that criticized the government. The government particularly targeted those who spoke up in support of the government of Ukraine or opposed the Russian government's activities in Ukraine. Further, the Russian government continued to selectively prosecute racial, ethnic, religious, and sexual minorities and migrant workers. In addition, officials denied due process to defendants in politically motivated cases. The government used secret detentions and convictions based on questionable treason and espionage charges, and even tried and convicted non-Russian citizens taken illegally from other countries, especially Ukraine. Yet at the same time, authorities failed to bring to justice individuals responsible for the deaths of prominent journalists, activists, whistleblowers, and opposition politicians. Indeed, Russia's support of separatists in eastern Ukraine and its two-year occupation of Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula were responsible for some of the worst human rights abuses in the region. According to international monitors and human rights NGOs, the combined Russian separatist forces in the Donbas region and the Russian occupation authorities in Crimea caused thousands of civilian deaths and injuries. Russian occupation authorities in Crimea cracked down on members of certain groups, in particular Ukrainians and Crimean Tatars, who spoke out in opposition to the occupation. And finally, conflict in northern Caucasus between government forces, insurgents, Islamist militants, and criminal forces led to numerous human rights abuses and a general degradation in the rule of law. Such abuses imperil the future of Russia and its people. In the words of Secretary of State John Kerry, a government that fails to respect human rights, no matter how lofty its pretensions, has very little to boast about, to teach, and very little indeed in the way of reaching its full potential.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.